Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And Ken, since we don't have anything we want to say at the top of the show today before we play the music, we're just going to go right into the question. What happened 159 years ago this week in the tiny town of Ripon, Wisconsin?
Our first podcast.
I remember it well.
The birth of the Republican Party.
Yes, more or less, because although this is disputed by a couple of other towns that think it started there, that was where the Whig Party of that day met with the Abolitionist Party of that day to see if they could, get together and kind of help each other. And from that union was born the Republican Party as we know it.
Well, the Republican Party as we know it is having some self-doubts, shall we say? Or, of course, after you lose a presidential election two times in a row, you do have reflection and where did we go wrong? We saw this with the Republican Party after 1964. Was Goldwater too conservative? Do we need to move more to the middle? After 1976, although there was only one in a row. But it seems like it's more difficult of a challenge this time because I don't think there's an obvious place where the Republican Party is going. The fact that we're calling Marco Rubio the establishment suddenly,
which he was a Tea Party candidate.
Yes, and he took on the establishment, taking on Charlie Crist and things like that.
In Florida.
Now he's suddenly the establishment choice against if Rand Paul is the opposite.
And Rand Paul is, of course, the son of Ron Paul, who used to be a fringe candidate, a Libertarian Party nominee for president in 1988, and then later on a Republican congressman and a presidential candidate who never got more than, 10, 11, 12% in any big primary. Right. Sometimes he did better in caucus states. But, Ron Paul was never a threat to get nominated for president. Now along comes his son. He's a senator. And people are talking about him having a serious shot in 2016. This is a different party.
Yes, but what seems to be counterproductive, though, is that after 64 and after 76, I think there was a concerted effort. Okay, how do we fix the party? Now it just seems like we're going, okay, who's going to be our standard bearer in 2016? Not solving the ills. Clearly in evidence, you could see this with the questions about same-sex marriage, the questions about immigration policy. There seems to be an uncertainty that's enveloping the party that didn't exist in the past.
Yes, even on gun control, although this has not been a great week for gun control advocates or for people who hoped that after Newtown we would finally get some tougher laws on assault weapons and so on. Still, there is also a schism or a rift within the Republican Party on gun policy, background checks, how much to be in bed with the NRA, and so on. So,
of course, the Democrats have that same problem.
They do, and there's no question about that. But right now, because of the results of the last two presidential elections, and really the results of the last six presidential elections to some degree, because the Democrats have won the popular vote in 5 out of 6. And the popular vote is going to continue to move in their direction if we believe that the demographic trends will continue and that the people who are rising populations, Hispanics, Asians, younger people, will continue to vote Democratic. So this is a really serious crisis, in some respects more serious than after 1964 for the Republicans or after 1976 for the Republicans, or after the 80s elections, the Reagan elections, the first Bush election for the Democrats.
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly after 64, when the Republican Party only got 6 states, Barry Goldwater only carried 6 states in the nation for the Republican Party in 1964. And yet 2 years later, they rebounded with big gains in the House and the Senate. And in 68, of course, Richard Nixon took the White House. So as bleak as things were after 64, that bleakness disappeared by the next election.
64 was an anomalous election.
Sure.
It was a collision of the
sympathy,
emotion that followed the assassination of JFK, the way that LBJ masterfully played that, what he did to use Vietnam to make him look tough on national defense and tough on communism. This is a different kind of crisis for the Republican Party, and they are in a much more serious situation, even though one could also argue they still have the House.
Majority of the governors.
And 30 governorships.
Right.
That's a lot. That's not a bare majority. They've got 30 governorships, and they'll probably hold on to the great majority of those in 2014.
Perhaps. But it seems to be more, again, the finger-pointing in the Republican Party. You know, when we saw the anger of the Tea Party when it came out in 2009, or at least when it broke through in 2009, their ire seemed to be directed at President Obama and the Democrats. Now it just seems like the Republicans are attacking each other, and everybody is looking at each other warily. I mean, you mentioned the Rand Paul versus Marco Rubio. Everything now seems suddenly as part of the 2016 calculation. And if all we're doing is worrying who the nominee is going to be, then the inherent problems of the party are not going to be addressed.
I think that's a very unfortunate thing for the Republican Party or any party if this soon after a presidential election that they lost and this far away from the next presidential election, that's the only thing they want to talk about, who they're going to nominate next time. That will pull them apart. What they wanted to concentrate on now is what brings them together. And we've just had this report this week from the Republican National Committee, which had a task force looking at the last election. Chairman Reince Priebus brought this report out in public and answered a lot of questions about it, went to the National Press Club. And here's one of the things that he had to say about this new report.
There's no one reason we lost. Our message was weak. Our ground game was insufficient. We weren't inclusive. We were behind in both data and digital. And our primary and debate process needed improvement. So there's no one solution. There's a long list of them.
Well, I mean, I think that's very simplistic, and I'm sure, obviously, Reince Priebus has a lot more to say than just, you know, the digital and data was lacking and our ground game was lacking. Obviously, Mitt Romney had a lot of problems, and the way the whole system was set up contributed to the problems when you have debates over and over again when, let's see, who could be the more anti-immigrant. But then you wonder, after the Republican Party loses and they say, well, you know, we need a better outreach for African-American voters. We need a better outreach for Latinos. And, of course, we saw a study by this. The Republicans have been doing this for decades, you know, going back to the 1980s. Here's what we need to do to attract black voters. Here's what we need to do to get Hispanics. And they keep saying the same thing over again. And the language is almost word for word, is what we've heard to this week.
Hats off to Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College in Southern California for putting together an extraordinary list of paragraphs from Republican reports. Even one of those years, they said, we're going to put together a $10 million program for outreach to minority voters. And what do you know? Not only is the language the same in this new Priebus report, but they're putting aside another $10 million for minority outreach. Clearly, the point being made by Jack Pitney, who's been a student of the Republican Party, is that $10 million in outreach means nothing if the party continues to have the positions that it has with respect to certain issues that matter to these communities.
Yes, but then you go back to the debate within the Republican Party now, whether the philosophy and your true convictions matter, or is it about winning the election? Do we know, do we have any idea why this sudden interest in Hispanic votes and the shifting, like Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, who is now being looked up for since his 13-hour filibuster, and even before that probably in his speech at CPAC last week.
He won the straw poll at CPAC.
Won the straw poll.
I mean, the straw poll's a meaningless thing, perhaps, but he was the guy who barely beat out Marco Rubio among the people attending that conference and voting in that straw poll.
But Rand Paul, who in the past have talked about stronger borders and, you know, I don't think he's talking about electrical fences, but of course he was a very strong, sometimes harsh voice on immigration. And yet what we heard this week to a Hispanic audience sounded like was a completely, in my view, a completely different tune. And Rand Paul talked about this in an interview this week on CNN.
What we're talking about is work visas. But if you want to get in line to become a citizen, we think that you don't have to leave the country and go back to Mexico or Central America. We would let you simply get in line, but you don't get to get in front of anyone in the line. So it doesn't get you in a green card line. It gets you in the line to enter the country legally to become a citizen like everybody else who wants to come from around the world to be a citizen. So it may take a little while, but I'm also in favor of maybe speeding up the line, allowing more work visas. And if you have a job in America, I see no reason why we wouldn't want to almost immediately get you a work visa.
Interesting, because that is what has been traditionally a liberal position with respect to immigration. And he is not ruling out that people could follow along and touch all of these various milestones along the path to citizenship. But he is also strongly sending a signal that there would not be 11 million brand new Hispanic voters in the next election. It's not going to happen that way. It's going to take some time.
Yes, but when you think of the Republican Party and you think of voices on immigration overhaul, whom do you think of? You think of Marco Rubio, a part of the Gang of Eight. So many people are now saying, well, if Marco Rubio is the leading candidate talking about immigration, maybe Rand Paul should be another voice in immigration. And you just wonder if this is just, I mean, you just have to ask the question whether it's just total calculation regarding 2016 or Rand Paul has become a leading voice in the Republican Party. I mean, we should also talk about the divisions on foreign policy. Obviously, Rand Paul's view of foreign policy, like his father's, was not certainly not Republican mainstream. But after non-successes in Iraq. We'll talk about the 10-year anniversary of Iraq. But after non-successes in Iraq and in Afghanistan, maybe the foreign policy excursions of the past bring us back to that isolationist pre-World War II era where, enough is enough.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, and I think we should pause just for a parenthesis here. We've been doing this podcast for nearly 7 years. If you go back 7 years to 2006, there was an emerging consensus that the war in Iraq had been a mistake, that perhaps there weren't weapons of mass destruction, and that perhaps the government had known more about that or been less certain that there really were such weapons than they let on. And this was pretty subversive at the time to be saying this after the invasion in 2003 had initially gone so well.
Right. Would Colin Powell lie to us? I mean, that's the feeling was. He went to the UN and said, here we have this information. And then when the information turned out to be not information, people started saying, whoa. You know, there was a lot of whoa.
Yes,
know?
There was a lot of whoa. And in the 2004 election, there was the emergent sense that George W. Bush maybe should be defeated because of the Iraq war, but that was not sufficient to defeat him. And
it was also a 9/11 war, too. Remember that?
That's correct. We were close to 9/11. And in 2005, things started to go south for George W. Bush. The Social Security thing didn't work out so well. There was Katrina. And the next thing you know, the Democrats are coming on in 2006. But when we started this podcast, it was still a very hot war in Iraq. We still had a large number of troops there. We were about to put in more troops in a surge,
right?
Which, you know, Republicans defend to this day as having been
Chuck
a
Hagel.
Successful way to have gotten out of that war. It was still a very live controversy. Now, here we are in 2013, and a CNN ORC poll that was done last week showed that nearly 60% of the people, given a choice between a smart thing to go into Iraq, a dumb thing to do, nearly 60% said it was a dumb thing to do. And even a bare majority said they thought the government had led us down the primrose path and the Bush administration had known more about those weapons than it let on. That's pretty stunning as a historical record.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking about the 7 years of our podcast, but of course this week was the 10th year anniversary of the war. And you think of where is the world 10 years later? And you can't say that Iraq is any safer. Certainly Iran is certainly emboldened. The Mideast isn't even any better off. There's no indication of any kind of change. I mean, we talked about the Arab Spring, but the Arab Spring has brought more chaos and more uncertainty, I think, than we had before. Not that despots was the great answer, but I don't know what the answer is now.
No, we don't.
But we do know that it has come at a cost to the Republican Party, and for all the positions they're trying to reevaluate, foreign policy is certainly one of them.
And going forward, for the 2014 elections and particularly for 2016, Republicans are going to have to decide whether they're the party that wants to get tougher with Iran, risk war with Iran, maybe go into war with Iran, or whether they're the party more of Rand Paul, who clearly has no stomach for that fight and does not seem interested at all in further American commitments in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, he's even against missile attacks on the United States, which I'm personally for.
I understand that. And, certainly you're one of those people who would most likely be on the list.
That's why I live at your house, Ron.
Yes. So bottom line on all this, the Republican Party with some really big issues to resolve internally. One of them we haven't mentioned, although we have talked a little bit about the problems that they've had with Hispanic voters, is this attitude towards voting rights and attitude towards whether or not the franchise is being too liberally applied, whether or not we should be dealing more strictly with voter fraud. And the reason that comes up this week is because in the midst of all this other news and the president going to Israel, the president appointed a new labor secretary whose name is Tom Perez.
Right. And Tom Perez, of course, is President Obama's chief, I guess, civil rights enforcer, top aide or something.
He's been the head of the civil rights division of the Department of Justice under Attorney General Eric Holder.
Right. And the Republicans say that he comes down on the side of the wrong side of bias and discrimination cases. And for all the problems we saw with the Susan Rice nomination, the Chuck Hagel nomination, although he was confirmed, there could be a Republican effort once again to use Thomas Perez as a civil rights example at the same time when they're ostensibly trying to increase their influence in Black and Latino communities.
Just showing once again, even when they identify the problem correctly, the very same day that Reince Priebus is talking about outreach to Hispanics and other minorities, you have a nominee from the president who has been their chief civil rights enforcer and has been a champion to those communities being immediately criticized by a number of Republican senators, one of whom, David Vitter of Louisiana, immediately said, I'm blocking that nomination. That's not going to fly. So we have the prospect of a filibuster, a real filibuster, a longer one than Rand Paul's 13 hours, a longer one than the failed filibuster against Chuck Hagel, to block the only Hispanic name to the second-term cabinet for the president?
That's right. He would be replacing Hilda Solis, who was leaving at Labor. You know, you were talking about the views in the Republican Party back in 2006 and the split over the war. Go back to 2008. When you think of the issue of same-sex marriage, which is now, of course, a big issue, it's heading to the Supreme Court next week. When you think of the Democratic Party, I mean, if you think of all the candidates, nobody, I mean, to a person, every leading Democratic candidate said, marriage is between a man and a woman. This was Hillary Clinton. This was Joe Biden. You know,
John Edwards.
John Edwards, certainly Bill Clinton.
I think John Edwards' position was that marriage was between a man and a woman and a woman.
And exactly, exactly. But anyway, we're talking about calculations for 2016. It was interesting to me, not so much Rob Portman, and that was interesting too. His, of course, is a senator from Ohio. He found out 2 years ago that his 21-year-old son is gay, and he's now opposed to the Defense of Marriage Act, which he was a sponsor of in 96. But Hillary Clinton...
You know, many people voted for the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996.
Overwhelming both parties. Well,
right. And not only did Bill Clinton sign it, now he says it was unconstitutional, but you had senators, you know, including some of the most liberal senators, Barbara Mikulski voted for it from Maryland.
Right. Right. Chuck Schumer, you had Pat Leahy, you had a lot of liberals in the House and Senate voting for it.
And now?
And now, of course, we saw Bill Clinton's op-ed in the Washington Post that it's unconstitutional. We, of course, have the already evolved position of President Obama and Vice President Biden from last year. And so we have HRC, Hillary Rodham Clinton, talking at the HRC, the Human Rights Coalition, last week explaining that new position.
LGBT Americans are our colleagues, our teachers, our soldiers, our friends, our loved ones. And they are full and equal citizens and deserve the rights of citizenship. That includes marriage. That's why I support marriage for lesbian and gay couples. I support it personally and as a matter of policy and law.
Hillary Clinton, what she's addressing seems to be the majority view in the Democratic Party. I'm not convinced that Rob Portman's party has accepted that point of view yet. Certainly, as we saw in CPAC last week, that's a minority position.
This is one of those elements that really makes Reince Priebus' job difficult in pulling together the Republican Party, because there is a huge age gap here where voters under 50, generally speaking, have accepted gay marriage. Voters over 50, not so much. Among Republicans, it's even more marked. You have acceptance of gay marriage among the youngest voters, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and you have real rejection and resistance to it among older Republican voters who have been their most reliable supporters and the people who have kept them in the game and elected those governors and elected that House. So they've got to be really careful about pushing those people out on an ice floe so that they can embrace a younger generation.
Yeah, and I'm not convinced that CPAC is completely representative of the Republican Party, but it certainly does indicate that age chasm, because when you go to CPAC, Ron Paul and now Rand Paul, so three times total, they won the straw poll because of young voters. The opposition to war, the opposition to drone attacks, the constitutionality, the questioning of the constitutionality of the drone attacks, those are younger, more libertarian conservatives that the Republican Party is not used to having to deal with, given the fact that their positions on foreign policy have been pretty much
Hawkish
and universal for the last several decades.
Well, it really goes back to the Reagan coalition of the 1980s, which was a marvelous, victorious creation of not just Ronald Reagan, but the times, and also a lot of people around Reagan who were making good use of their skills, their appreciation of where the votes were. Ed Rollins, to throw out another shout out to somebody who doesn't get mentioned positively too often these days, but back in the 1970s and 80s, he really had a good grip on where the voting majority was. And they could see that if you put together an anti-Soviet, anti-communist foreign policy with lower taxes and a very old-fashioned approach to social issues, neighborhood, work, family.
Crime.
And, well, that was sort of all kind of gathered together in the idea of neighborhood, family, and work. And they were sending all kinds of dog whistle messages to the majority of voters in America. But they did it very artfully, and they did it with a lot of positive spin. And it brought a lot of people together who had never voted together over the previous 50, 60 years, all the way back to the New Deal. It was a marvelous achievement. And now the pressures of the passage of time are pulling it apart. There's no communism, really. That's not really a big fear for the average voter under 50. And you've got all kinds of other things that really worked for Ronald Reagan that don't exist anymore, like inflation. We may have inflation in the next few years. We don't have any right now. So all these things that glued together that marvelous coalition in the 1980s, very successful, not there.
Ron, this is very deep. Okay, ready? I'm thinking that the Reagan coalition is like Yugoslavia. Huh?
I like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How is it like Yugoslavia?
I don't know. That's all I thought of. I don't have any more to say about that.
Okay. All right. But next week.
Oh, yeah. I have a lot more. I'll have two more sentences.
Understood.
Yeah.
A few other things we'd like to talk about before we end this week's podcast and look forward to that very informative and educational podcast coming up next week.
Two sentences.
Definitely South Carolina.
Yes. Yes. Of course, not a surprise. This was Tuesday's Republican primary in South Carolina's 1st congressional district. This is the one that Mark Sanford once represented before he became the governor of Argentina.
And took a walk down the Appalachian Trail.
That's right. And, of course, he won. He got 37% in a 16-candidate field.
37%?
Well, you know, something, I mean, that's not great, but that's, of course, what...
16 candidates.
I mean, everybody's saying, well, you know, the Republican Party obviously doesn't like Mark Sanford because 63% voted for somebody else other than Mark Sanford. Well,
except all those somebody's else. Can you name three other people who were in that race?
Well, I could name Curtis Bostick.
Okay,
all right. Second. I can mention Larry Grooms, who was barely beaten out for the runoff. Teddy Turner.
Oh, yes, the son of
Ike and Tina Turner, the great Eisenhower.
Actually, I think it was probably Ted Turner.
Ted Turner.
But not Jane Fonda. It was
no,
that's
his stepmother. Right.
Okay.
But Ted Turner finished fourth. Larry Grooms finished third because I predicted he would get into the runoff. That's why he finished third. But Curtis Bostick, former local councilman in Charleston, backed by evangelicals and churches, obviously the anti...
Don't like Mark Sanford's adultery too much.
But Bostick doesn't live in the district.
Oh,
he doesn't have that much money.
Darn.
And I'm thinking that, you know, something... Certainly, the anti-Mark Sanford voters could coalesce around
Bostick.
And I agree with you. April 2nd,
not
no.
Happen.
I think he does win it. Now the question is whether he beats the Democrat,
Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
Colbert Bush.
It's so hard to stop saying Colbert because her brother Stephen is so much more famous with the mispronounced last name. But her name is Colbert.
Yep.
And Colbert. Her last name is a hyphen and then B-U-S-A. C.H. Bush, like the beer people, not like the politics people.
Doesn't Colbert Bush sound like a beer parody?
I was going to say, I could use a Colbert Bush right now. I would say...
What would you say, Ron?
Just offhand, she gets close, she doesn't beat you.
Well, yes, I agree with that. I mean, people do like the politics of redemption. And, of course, there are some people who will never forgive Mark Sanford and have always forgiven Bill Clinton. But anyway, I agree with you. I think Mark Sanford does win, but Elizabeth Colbert Bush, with the media attention... could run a very strong race in the May runoff.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week, won't you, for It's All Politics from NPR.
That's when I'll have those two sentences. Yeah,
but I'm really
Yugoslavia.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Forgiveness. Forgiveness.
Oh, and I get it. Like Yugoslavia, because there were like lots and lots of little parts.
Uh-huh.
And now they're just flying apart.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
They let you down. You know they hurt your pride. You better put it all behind you, babe, 'cause life goes on.